good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of Hitler's Table Talk. It is Thursday, April 24th, and we, Ray Goodwin and I, are back. We're very happy about this. It's been 14 days since our last episode. I had said it was my first priority for getting on the air again, and so it is the first program to return. On Monday, the Heretics Hour will return after exactly 2 weeks. So I'm feeling very good tonight, kind of like how Hitler was feeling during those 1941 talks that we're into right now. That's what Ray and I have been saying, that he was in a very good mood, and I'm in a good mood tonight. What would you like to say by way of introduction, Ray?
Well, I'm really glad to be back and reaching people who are interested in this table talk discussion. That's, as you already said, Carolyn, the tone of tonight's show and the Hitler Notes is very optimistic and upbeat, particularly right at the first. So that's always enjoyable to me.
Well, it is. It feels good when your people you like are having good things are going well. Mm-hmm. I just mentioned before you start reading, I want you to start, if you will, please.
Okay.
That there, I did have one timeline item because we're starting on the night of late night, 25th and 26th September. That was, over midnight, during midnight. And on September 26th, what's on the timeline is that the U.S. Naval Command orders an all-out war on Axis shipping in American waters. What do you think of that? Now, here it was September. It wasn't December yet. It wasn't after Pearl Harbor. But the Naval Command ordered an all-out war on Axis shipping. Do you know anything about that?
Well, that came straight from Roosevelt and his advisors, and it was a total violation of our neutrality laws, and it was kept, the knowledge of that was kept from the populace as best they could keep it from them. But it was just more of the effort to get the United States involved.
That's right. I would certainly agree with that. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if you want to say anything more or if you want to start reading, whatever.
Okay, we'll take off with the night of 25th and the night that carries on over into the 26th of September 1941. This directly from Adolf Hitler. I've been thrilled by our contemporary news films. We are experiencing a heroic epic without precedent in history. Perhaps it was like this during the First World War, but nobody was able to get a clear picture. I'm extremely happy to have witnessed such deeds. I'm told that the reason why my speech made such an impression is that I don't coin rhetorical phrases. And my own note right here, I think he's referring to a speech about the fighting man, the soldier, and the rough life that they live and the dedication they have. Now go on. He says, I could never make the mistake of beginning a speech with the words, there is no fairer death in the world, for I know the reality, and I also know how the soldier feels about it.
So let me interrupt here, because I also wondered what speech he would be referring to, and I just figured it was a speech, a recent one he had done, and since this was September 41, the closest one I could find previous to that was his June 22nd, 1941 speech to the German people on the invasion of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the one? Are you thinking of another one? I couldn't find a...
No, it was that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's probably it then.
Okay. The revelation that her encounter with her first man is, for a young woman, can be compared with the revelation that a soldier knows when he faces war for the first time. In a few days, a youth becomes a man. If I weren't myself hardened by this experience, I would have been incapable of undertaking this cyclopean task which the building of an empire means for a single man. It was with feelings of pure idealism that I set out for the front in 1914. Then I saw men falling around me in the thousands. Thus I learnt that life is a cruel struggle and has no other object but the preservation of the species. The individual can disappear, provided there are other men to replace him. I suppose that some people are clutching their heads with both hands to find an answer to this question. How can the Führer destroy a city like St. Petersburg? plainly, I belong by nature to quite another species. I would prefer not to see anyone suffer, not to do harm to anyone. But when I realize that the species is in danger, then, in my case, sentiment gives way to the coldest reason. I become uniquely aware of the sacrifices that the future will demand to make up for the sacrifices that one hesitates to allow today.
Yeah, well, you might have something you want to say about that, but I thought that was just fantastic.
I agree 100%. Uh-huh. I'll underline that because it's so important when he says, we have got to jump out and take care of this right now, because the more we ease off on or shy away from, for whatever reasons, it's going to cost us in the future. And the Führer had a very long-range mind, thinking long-range, which is unfortunately a very rare thing for a leader to think long-range these days. But he saw down the road that if they did not take care of business today, then the future was going to come back and extract a very heavy price on them.
Well, right, and we know this today, too. Mm-hmm. We know that as we've been going on and on with all this non-white immigration, or
that's
anyway,
right.
You know, immigration that's not of our people into our homelands, and we don't do anything about it. We know what's going to happen to us in the future, and still people are not willing to do anything. Except a few people, but they don't have any power. So it's just amazing that this is the way things go. And Adolf Hitler had come to so many realizations at a young age already, when he was a lot younger than this. And he had a very tough mind when it came to realities, I think.
That's
and
right.
People today, I'll talk about this at some future time on a future program, but so many people today are trying to make Hitler into a hero for everyone who is was really such a good guy. They're trying so hard to make him look like, you know, a nice person, and he really wasn't all these bad things that are being said about him, thinking that that's going to change the mentality about him, whereas, you know, it's distorting who he was. He was not any kind of a monster, but he was prepared to do some very unkind, you might say, things for the necessary good that he saw was necessary. So this is the way I am seeing him more clearly these days. So I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Well, I think you're right on the spot there, Carolyn, because he was an extremely practical fella, and he had to be. And, you know, the kind of a close-your-eyes-to-pity type thing.
Right.
Things that have to be done. And he took the bull by the horns, and you know, so many people lack that courage. And, you know, that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and they use the word hard a lot in amongst the National Socialists and the people in his government. They knew that was something that was a kind of a, I want to say, I can't think of it, but it was something that was current among all of them. That they had to be hard. They had to be hard because,
yes,
you know, Germans are not really hard people, and everybody would like to, you know, be nicer and so on. But it was the long range program, and they saw the Jew as clearly then as a very vicious enemy as we see him now today.
Sure.
Yeah.
The plan for the Thousand Year Reich. And down the road, how it was going to be for everybody, for the average German, the little guy, you might say, and how much life was going to be improved. But Hitler was always, you know, willing to tell people that to reach that level, there is a price to pay, and that price is sometimes going to be very disagreeable and whatever, but it's unavoidable if we don't do those little things that we should now, then we will never reach that level that we're looking for in the Thousand Year Reich.
Yeah.
And so,
okay, let's go on.
Okay, the night of the 27th, 28th September 1941. We must pursue two aims: to hold our positions on the Eastern Front at all costs, to keep the war as possible from our frontiers.
As far as possible.
Yeah, as far as possible, correct. By considering what Bolshevism has made of man, one realizes that the foundation of all education should be respect. Respect toward providence, or the unknown, or nature, or whatever name one chooses. Secondly, the respect that youth owes to maturity. In this, if this respect is lacking, a man falls below the level of the animal. His intelligence, when it ceases to be controlled, turns him into a monster. The Russian finds his place in human society only in its collectivist form. That is to say, he's tied to work by horrible compulsion. The spirit of society, mutual consideration, etc., are to him things unknown. Who knows? If my parents had been sufficiently well-to-do to send me to a school of art, I should not have made the acquaintance of poverty as I did. Excuse me. Whoever lives outside poverty cannot really become aware of it unless by overthrowing a wall. The years of experience I owe to poverty, a poverty that I knew in my own flesh, are a blessing for the German nation. But for them, we'd have Bolshevism today. In one respect, the climate of want in which I lived left no mark on me. At that time, I lived in palaces of the imagination, and it was precisely at that time that I conceived the plans for the new Berlin. We must pay attention to two things: that all gifted adolescents are educated at the state's expense, and that no door is closed to them. Since I hadn't been able to finish my secondary studies, an officer's career would have been closed to me, even if by working I had learnt more about it than is proper for a boy who has matriculated to know. Only an officer could win the Pour le Mérite, and at that, it was quite exceptional for an officer of middle-class origin to receive it. In that closed society, every man existed only by virtue of his origin. The man who lacked this origin and university degrees into the bargain could not dream of becoming a minister, and in that sense of the word, the word minister means a minister in government, for example, except by the shortcut of social democracy. Until not long ago, we had four different styles of messing in the Navy, meaning feeding, corresponding to the sailors' ranks or ratings. Very recently, that even cost us a ship. The view that suppression of these discriminations would be harmful to authority proved to be without foundation. A competent man always has the authority he needs. A man who is not superior by his talent invariably lacks authority, whatever his job may be. It's a scandal to remember how household servants used to be lodged, particularly in apartments in Berlin. And the crews on ships, even luxury ships, what an insult. I know that all of that can't be changed by a single stroke of the pen and everywhere at once, but the general attitude towards that sort of thing is very different today from what it used to be. In future, every worker will have his holidays, a few days in each year which he can arrange as he likes, and everybody will be able to go on a sea cruise once or twice in his life. It's nonsense to fear that people will lose their modest ways of living. They should lose them, for that kind of modesty is the enemy of all progress. In this matter, we see things like the Americans, and not like the Spaniard, who would content himself with a few olives a day rather than work to have more. The church has been able to profit by this conception of life. It proclaims that the poor in spirit, and the other poor too, will go to heaven, whilst the rich will pay with eternal sufferings for the blessings of earthly existence. The church is moved to say this by the tacit contract between the priest and the possessors, who joyfully leave the church a little money so that it may go on encouraging the poor to grovel. But what a queer sort of Christianity they practice down there. We must recognize, of course, that amongst us, Christianity is colored by Germanism. All the same, its doctrine signifies pray and work.
See, now, I thought that was so funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he's always bringing that up about the Germans, but he also likes that about the Germans because he knows he can depend on their hardworking nature mm-hmm. and their discipline and their, you know, attention to getting things done and so on. So he likes it, but he makes a little bit of fun of it. Pray and work, yeah. Well, gee, there. I want to go all the way back to the beginning of that section.
Good.
And let's see, did I went too far?
I had a note back at the start that I wanted to bounce off of you, too.
Okay. Yeah, I bet. Well, I just have that these first two items that he mentioned, mm-hmm. That it's like to hold our position, to keep the war as far as possible from our frontiers was the second one. Mm-hmm. And that required the first one to hold our positions on the Eastern Front at all costs. So there I see the reason for his later unreasonable orders, as people saw them. Mm-hmm. They expected these poor soldiers when they were all worn out already and they didn't have enough of anything to keep holding. But that was the philosophy he took into it. And it was probably very hard for him to let it go. Plus, mm-hmm. he knew that once you start retreating, that retreat doesn't end. And mm-hmm. so he hoped that they could, but the generals sometimes up close there saw that that was just, you know, it was asking way too much, and they were already they really gave their all. There's terrible things going on.
True.
Later on that front. So what were you going to say about it?
Well, regarding what you just said, we'll get into this later, but when we get over to 27th, 28th. There is a couple of three sentences that reference exactly what you just said, and mm-hmm. and I made note on that. So when I get to that, we'll talk about that. But what you know, when we started discussing this book, part of our purpose, I think, was to decide for ourselves after week after week after week of reading this, is it really Adolf Hitler? Was it Martin Bormann? Were these really Hitler's words and things like this? And I think you and I are of a like mind on that, certainly.
I was thinking exactly the same thing about this particular passage, Ray.
Yes, yes.
I wanted to talk about it, but I thought, well, I didn't know if I should mm-hmm. take up the time. But
it was the very point there where it says, by considering what Bolshevism has made of man, one realizes that the foundation of all education should be respect towards providence. Now, Hitler used that word providence often. Now, in parentheses there, right behind it, are the unknown or nature or whatever name one chooses. Now, I was wondering, could this have been a Bormann insertion? Not that it makes a hell of a lot of difference about anything, but you know, I think that possibly knowing Bormann and his ideas on the creation and mm-hmm. things like this, I could very very easily see Bormann putting those words in there.
Yeah, or maybe the Chaim, who is mm-hmm. taking the notes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of funny that it doesn't seem like it could very easily not be Hitler because it's in parentheses.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
And they wouldn't put it in parentheses if he said it. I don't
yes.
think. So I think you're probably right mm-hmm. that was put in there to clarify what he meant by providence or what it could have been.
Sure.
At this point. So you could probably leave that out, you know?
Yeah.
Just delete that part because it's not necessary.
Right.
All right. Good point. That's a very good point, Ray.
Thank you. Okay. Do you want to take this 29th?
Well, let me see if there's something else. You know, I like he says.
Sure.
How important, and he said this in Mein Kampf. He said it in many places. This is one reason people could say, well, because anybody who read his other stuff could have written this, you know, and make it sound like he's saying it. But he did repeat himself a lot. There are certain themes he had that, and this was one thing that was very clear to him, that his time as a very poor person gave him something that he said you just couldn't get. He even says that the years that he was living in poverty are a gift, our blessing for the German nation today because of all that it gave him and his understanding human beings and so on and what it was all about. So, okay, we're... and then also, as you often point out, he found good things in social democracy.
Yeah.
You want me to read this 29th September 1941 midday?
Sure.
The state of our relations with England is like that which existed between Prussia and Austria in 1866. The Austrians were shut up in the notion of their empire as the English are today in their commonwealth. When things go badly for his country, no Englishman lets anything of the sort appear before a foreigner. No Englishman ever leaves his country without knowing what he should reply to questions that might be asked him on thorny topics. They are an admirably trained people. They work for 300 years to assure themselves the domination of the world for two centuries. The reason why they've kept it so long is that they were not interested in washing the dirty linen of their subject peoples. What we would like to do, on the other hand, meaning we Germans, would be to rub a Negro until he becomes white, as if someone who feels no need to wash himself were to want to let himself be soaked by somebody else. We must be careful not to push organization too far, for the slightest accident can jam the whole machine. For example, it would be a mistake to decree that in the Ukraine, the quality of the soil means that we should sow nothing but wheat. No, we must also leave room for pastures. Nature has made the various regions of the earth in such a way as to ensure a sort of autarky for each. And man must respect this modified kind of order. We shall therefore let the marshlands continue to exist, not only because they will be useful to us as fields for maneuvers, but also in order to respect the local climatological conditions and to prevent the desert from gradually encroaching on the fertile regions. The marshes play the role of a sponge. Without them, it might happen that a whole crop was wiped out by a wave of heat. Well, that was a short one, and probably just some odds and ends that he said there, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know that last part you read, Carolyn, about in order to respect local climatological conditions, that is another one of the very many examples that pop up all the time about the man's wide variety of knowledge on different subjects. And he's aware that if you go to messing with nature in an area, the shock waves that go out from that and affect so many other things. And, you know, let's leave these marshlands the way they were created and meant to be, because they determine whether or not there's a drought that's going to kill everything around it and things like that. But, you know, nature and the various regions of the earth and ensuring a sort of autarky for each one, meaning that they are systems within themselves and they can exist on their own, but if you interfere with them to change them, you're upsetting the balance of nature. That's kind of what I read into what he was saying.
Well, yeah, and I know you're an environmentalist very much, and he was too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's very important that we... you know, environmentalism has gotten kind of a bad name, tied in with a bunch of crazy liberals and so on. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very important, and deserves a lot of respect. Well, the next one is about Vienna. I'd like to read this one on Vienna.
Sure.
And so then after that, you can read.
Sure.
So we're at 1st October. We're jumping around in the dates a little bit here. We couldn't figure out why, but in this particular portion, we go back and forth from September into October and back to September and so on. But according to the text, it's 1st October 1941 in the evening, and he was talking about Vienna and art, and he says, "What complicates things in Vienna is the racial diversity." And, of course, Austria was now part of Germany since 1938 already, and it was called the Ostmark. It wasn't even called Austria anymore. But Vienna is a tremendously more important in Austria than any other place, that more so than in some other capital cities in other countries. So he says it has this racial diversity. It contains the descendants of all the races that the old Austria used to harbor, and thus it is that everyone receives on a different antenna, and everyone transmits on his own wavelength. You know, he doesn't like that aspect
right.
very much. What's lacking in Austria and what we have in Germany is a series of towns of a high cultural level, and which therefore don't suffer either from an inferiority complex or from megalomania. In the old Austria, Vienna had such a supremacy that one can understand the hatred the provinces felt against her. No such sentiment in a similar form was ever expressed against Berlin. Treasures of every kind were always accumulated in Vienna, like the Ambras collection. Everything in Austria took its tune from Vienna, and jealous care was taken that this principle shouldn't be interfered with. Linz Cathedral, Linz where he lived for so long, Linz Cathedral, for example, couldn't be built to the prearranged height, simply so that the Tower of St. Stephen's, which is Vienna's pride and joy, shouldn't cease to be the tallest in the country. The genuine Viennese turned green when they learned that a single painting can have ended up in Graz or somewhere else instead of finding its way to Vienna. I hope, anyway, that Schirach has not let himself be attacked by the Vienna bug. Schirach is Balder von Schirach, who he has some important posts there.
Yeah, he's the director of Hitler Youth.
Yeah, but he also had some other important posts
yeah,
there.
Oh, yeah, Gauleiter and regional governor, yeah, correct.
Okay, good. And then Hitler goes on. Vienna has such treasures that every German should nevertheless bear in mind that he shares in this wealth. I may say in passing that, other things being equal, of course, what there is in Vienna can bear comparison with what I saw in Paris. Of course, the Concord Tuileries vista is magnificent, but what about the detail? We'll do still better. Vienna has a lot of monuments that ought to be classified. At the museum, they should take away that canvas cloth that's covering the walls. That cloth is hiding a magnificent stucco lustro. Vienna ought to declare war on bugs and dirt. The city must be cleaned up. That's the one and only duty for the Vienna of the 20th century. Let her but perform that, and she'll be one of the loveliest cities in the world. Ha ha.
Very, very neat.
Yes.
And back over towards the first, Carolyn, where what's lacking in Austria and what we have in Germany is a series of towns of a high cultural level and which therefore don't suffer either from an inferiority complex or from megalomania. And, the message I think he sends by saying words like that is we have nothing to prove to anyone. What you see and experience speaks for itself. We don't have to flaunt it like Vienna does, and Vienna puts itself in a superior position to the rest of Austria and wants to make them envious of what they got and no one else has.
Yeah, well, that can happen, in an empire like Vienna was.
Oh,
the
yes.
Where,
that's
you
right.
know, your one main capital city is just, overdone, and everything else is the less for it.
Yeah, and what he's actually saying there is that people who are shut out from all of that art, all of that culture, and made to feel like it's Vienna's, it's not ours, that is very negative for the country as a whole, for the people's unity. They need, like he says, they need to feel that they are a part of this. And drawing the comparison there to the German cities, what we have that they don't have, is something that we don't have to brag about. We don't have to boast and do whatever, because what you see and what you experience, that's what we are.
And, when you first started talking about that, Ray, I thought that you were going to say, and I thought it was very good. I hadn't thought about it myself at all. But what you brought to my mind was that he could also be kind of thinking about German cities, or Berlin and Vienna and Munich and so on, compared in comparison to the rest of Europe, and that German culture stands up to any culture in Europe and doesn't have it, shouldn't have an inferiority complex, or shouldn't be megalomaniac about itself. I think that would apply very well to that, because you know, he was he thought that he liked Paris very much, and he appreciated what the great things there, but he didn't think it was any better than
what they had.
That's good. That was good commenting. Why don't you then go ahead?
Okay, we'll go on with the nights of the 27th and 28th of September 1941, and the night the 9th of October 1941. The Duce has his difficulties because his army thinks royalist, because the Internationale of the priest has its seat in Rome, and because the state, as distinguished from the people, is only half fascist. Give official praise to a unit that has suffered a reverse, and you attack its military honor. Such a unit must be clearly shown that its behavior has been miserable. An army can sometimes have a moment of weakness. It can happen that the troops in the line become subject to fleeting impressions of which the command takes no account in its appreciation of the facts, but in such cases one must know how to be harsh. A unit that has fought badly must be sent back under fire as soon as possible. One can triumph over death only through death. If you retreat, you'll be shot. If you advance, you may save your skin. It's only after the unit has redeemed itself that one can wipe the slate. Of course, a command has no right to act recklessly by sending men to death without purpose. It is not enough to try to obtain by the employment of masses what one couldn't obtain by more modest methods. One would simply be running the risk of increasing the number of victims without gaining anything. There are cases in which it's important, first of all, to reflect in order to discover the cause of the reverse. One must know how to have recourse to other methods or else to change one's tactics. When all is said, one can likewise ask oneself whether one would not be doing better to give up a position that's difficult to hold or consider a completely different operation. And right there, that's what I was referring to a few minutes ago when we talked about his insistence that we hold every position on the Eastern Front. We keep the war as far away from our borders as possible. Because when I read that last couple of sentences there, the thoughts of Stalingrad hit me like a ton of bricks. And so, anyway, going on.
Yeah, well, he's saying that it was, you have to say that maybe it'd be better to give up a position.
That's right.
That's too difficult.
That's exactly right.
I'm sure he was willing to do that many times, but there are these times when he's known, or at least he's been said to have been insisted, don't give an inch,
yes.
hold your line, and people criticize him for that and say that he was trying to run things that he wasn't qualified to do.
Correct. Okay, moving on.
Yeah, I like this part too. Everybody should pay attention here.
A few weeks ago, Antonescu, in a communique, accused one of his units of being a disgrace to the nation. Antonescu is of Germanic origin, not Romanian. He's a born soldier. His misfortune is to have Romanians under his command. But let's not forget that only a year ago, these people were wildly fleeing from the Bolsheviks. It's wonderful how, in so short a time, Antonescu has been able to get what he has got out of his troops. Doubtless, he will also succeed with time in obtaining administrators who aren't rotten with corruption. Our own people hasn't always been as impeccable as it is nowadays. Remember the saber blows that Frederick Wilhelm I used to administer to the Berliners with his own hand? Moral cleanliness is the result of a long education ceaselessly directed towards discipline.
Yeah. You know, this is really interesting because when he's talking about some of this, he's talked about that before. In fact, he used a lot of these arguments about how you don't praise people for their defeat,
mm-hmm.
even if they acted well or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And talking some pretty hard stuff here. you know, and you have to send people right back into action if they've dishonored themselves in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Because he thinks that everybody has the right to honor themselves, and nobody should be allowed to continue on in a dishonored state. He said these very same things in the speech, in the Platterhoff speech, that in more detail. And that was 43 or 44, I think it was. It was when things were not going too well, so maybe it was already 44. And now this is 41. So, you know, he's got these. Now people could say, well, somebody was reading all his material and then they wrote this thing. Because there are people who say this whole book is a big fake, not just that Vorman messed with it, but that, you know, I don't know how they can think that, but they do. And they could say, well, somebody read through all this stuff and then wrote this book to sound convincing. You know, why anybody would go to all that trouble, I don't know, but it would take a lot of work. But the way I see it, these are some ideas that he had, and he just kept working on them, or kept mm-hmm. repeating them, and got more into it as time went on. That, I mean, we're all like that, don't we? We have certain kind of ruling ideas that we really do believe in, and we bring up again and again. So I thought that was interesting, and I've talked about his, well, what it says about his personality and his beliefs about what needed to be done. But also when he mentions that Antonescu is of Germanic origin. Well, you know, I looked him up, and you could say he looks German, but he could look like a lot of other things too. He's a very good-looking man. And Hitler liked him quite a bit, admired him. But here again is another case where he's saying something that would make now the Romanians, though, aren't Slavic. They're not even a Slavic people. There might be some Slavs there, or some Slav blood, but they're something else. But he's putting down the Romanians too, although we know that the Romanians had a reputation of throwing down their weapons and running away.
Mm-hmm.
But they also fought very well under a lot of situations, and probably some of the units were better than others. I don't know, and maybe it depends on what they were facing. But they were good allies, although they didn't come up to the German level of a soldier and in the general. And Hitler maybe wants to call Antonescu German because he thinks so highly of him.
Sure. Well, you know, I think all of his remarks to do with combat, the military situation, are all definitely linked to his own experience in World War One.
Mm-hmm.
And how his worldview was so shaped by that conflict, the savagery, the loss, the betrayal back home and things like this. And it conditions him to make these remarks later on like this in a convincing and a forthright and a very positively influential way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think about his service in World War One when he says these things.
Well, right, and he brings it up too.
Mm-hmm.
He brought it up in the beginning. He may bring it up some more, but that's why for this show I picked out a picture of World War One soldiers.
Yeah.
It's not a whole lot to choose from, but because I feel that this is kind of the underlying theme here is his experience that made him the man that he is. And as he said, people are dying all around you. You've never seen that before in your life, and you just have to keep going. It turns a boy into a man.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you're still reading.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
All right. We'll go on to the night of the 9th and 10th of October, 1941. We Germans are alone responsible that the tide of Huns, Avars, and Magyars was halted in Central Europe. We were already a great empire when the English were only beginning to build up their maritime power. If we hadn't been such fools as to tear each other to pieces in order to find out whether we should consume God in the forms of bread and wine or of bread only, England would never have been able to have her say concerning the balance of power on the continent. England is never a danger except when she can oppose a power who threatens her supremacy with other powers whom she induces to play her game. For England, the First World War was a Pyrrhic victory. To maintain their empire, they need a strong continental power at their side. Only Germany can be this power. A lot said right there.
Really?
Yeah. You know, with the he's referring to if the various German tribes, if you want to call them that, hadn't torn each other to pieces over the Reformation, the Martin Luther splitting from the Catholic Church over religious dogma, England would never have been able to kick everybody to a smaller position in Europe.
The 30 Years' War is probably one thing that he's referring to there.
Yes.
Because that they really did tear each other to pieces over
mm-hmm.
these religious ideas.
Yes.
And they weren't even serious ones. They just got
right.
carried away.
Right.
And this is where he breaks with religion and Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has a deep faith, I think, in God and in higher guidance and mm-hmm. sacredness of things. He doesn't come out and attack it or anything, but personally he makes these kind of remarks quite often. And they're quite witty, too, I must say,
mm-hmm.
even though they're about something terrible. But and, of course, if anybody doesn't know what Pyrrhic means, it means a ruinous victory.
Yes,
it was
yes.
something in Pyrrhus, in one of the Romans' battles.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's lived on, and that means a victory, kind of like the British victory in World War One and World War Two. Huh?
Yes, yes, meaning yeah. that they came out on the winning side, but they lost. So,
yeah.
Okay, we move on to the night of the 25th, 26th of September, 1941, and the night of 9th and 10th, October of 41.
Very strange date. And
okay.
We've got 15 minutes
okay.
left, so
okay.
we're good.
All right, good. For the sake of the future, it's important to preserve the news films of the war. They'll be documents of incalculable value. New copies of these films will have to be constantly printed, and it would even be best to print them on strips of metal so that they won't disappear. I succeeded in getting my hands on some rare shots of the First World War. They'd been collected for destruction. But they were confiscated by the Bavarian state at the same time as the party's other possessions were confiscated. I could never find out what became of them, and they must be regarded as lost. I hope that in the future, news films will be made by our very best film experts. One can get extraordinary results in that field. They can confine themselves to 20-minute one-reelers, but these must be the result of intelligent work. The worst habit of all has been to restrict the films to 30-foot strips. Whatever the subject might be, an earthquake, a tennis match, a horse race, the launching of a ship.
Yeah, so there he is interesting himself in this.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever he looks, whatever's going on, he, you know, his mind thinks about things about it, forms some opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, excuse me, I was just going to say, I think he's referring to 1923. The push when the Bavarian state, when he says they took so many other things from the party's possessions, along with his newsreel films of World War One, the Bavarian state took those from.
When he was put in prison.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
correct. So, okay.
Yeah, yeah, probably. So there's always a lot of loss of things that can't get back.
Right. Okay, we're going to move on to the 10th of October, 1941, midday. War has returned to its primitive form. The war of people against people is giving place to another war, a war for the possession of the great spaces. Originally, war was nothing but a struggle for pasture grounds. Today, war is nothing but a struggle for the riches of nature. By virtue of an inherent law, these riches belong to him who conquers them. The great migrations set out from the east. With us begins the ebb from west to east. That's in accordance with the laws of nature. By means of the struggle, the elites are continually renewed. The law of selection justifies this incessant struggle by allowing the survival of the fittest. Christianity is a rebellion against natural law, a protest against nature. Taken to its logical extreme, Christianity would mean the systematic cultivation of the human failure.
Well, there's that, another one of those oft-quoted
mm-hmm.
phrases where they say, you know, he's shows he's not a Christian And then others say, Christians say, oh, well, he never said that because before he said other things and so on. So, but there it is. But it makes sense, you know, because he's talking about the fight for what you need, the riches, he says, belongs to him who conquers them. I mean, this is not acceptable today in our new version of how everybody has self-determination and every people should have their own land and their own place and do what they want there. But how much has that ever really taken place, you know?
Right.
It's the idea today. But he's not saying that. He's saying that it's not going to happen because these little places are not going to be protected. And some big guy's going to come and conquer them and take it over. And if that's going to happen, let's us be big and strong and let's us take over what we need. Mm-hmm. So that's just that's the law of... you know, of survival.
Survival of the fittest. And, you know, when he talks, Carolyn, about this, the great migrations set out from the east with us begins the ebb from west to east. And you know, of course, my thoughts, having been an instructor of American history, certainly the settlement of our continent and what it today is the United States, the area of the United States, North America, started from the east and rolled west. And you have Germany now, the migrations from the east that have moved there. Now it's time to turn around and go the other way, west moving to the east, securing the Ukraine, securing the territory to the east, to the east of Germany, for the survival of not only the German people but Europe.
That's right. That's right. And he saw and so many times said that Ukraine was to be the breadbasket for Europe, and he really believed that because there's you know, great soil there, and there was nothing else going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like there was some big civilization there or...
Right.
Or, you know...
There was so much there that was, I won't say going to waste, but it was not being utilized.
That's right. It wasn't. You're right. It wasn't. Okay, that's so true. But, all right, we've got 9.5 minutes or so,
okay. So
I think we'll just start. Oh, that's not so long. Why don't you read the next one? You're doing very well.
Sure. Thank you. The night of the 10th and 11th of October, 1941. Apart from the great victories like the Battle of Tannenberg and the Battle of the Masurian Marshes, the Imperial High Command proved itself inadequate. The Kaiser put in an appearance on one single occasion because he believed that all would go well. During the great offensive of 1918, it was trumpeted around that the Kaiser was commanding it in person. The truth was the Kaiser had no notion of command. The fact that there was no recognition on our side of the need for tanks, or at least for an anti-tank defense, is the explanation of our defeat. Bolshevism will collapse likewise for lack of anti-tank weapons. On the other hand, the spring offensive of 1918 was premature. A month later, the ground would have been dry and the meteorological conditions favorable. The terrain was likewise ill-chosen. How absurd, too, to have abandoned the agreed plan simply because, in the course of the operation, attention was incidentally drawn to Paris. It's the same as if, instead of ordering the troops of the Smolensk sector to head southward in view of the prearranged battles of encirclement and annihilation, I'd have made them march on Moscow to gain a prestige victory. It would have dangerously extended our front line, and I'd have wasted the already realized profit from the operation on which I'd decided. The most intelligent commander in the First World War was very possibly Conrad von Hotzendorf. He clearly recognized necessities that were at once political and military. Only his tools failed him. He was commanding the Austrian army.
He's always putting down that Austrian, not the Austria under him, but
right.
The Austrians before. He certainly had no love for it, and he did it in Mein Kampf. He made it very clear what he thought of that empire. And the Habsburgs.
What struck me about that little section about that night of the 10th and 11th of October, was the part about the fact that there was no recognition on our side of the need for tanks, or at least anti-tank defense, is the explanation of our defeat. Hey, for what was Germany so famous for when that war, when it took off, was the Lightning War, the Blitzkrieg, and what did they do it with? Panzer divisions. Mm-hmm. And that shows right there, when he says that, he recognized from the First World War that had we had tanks, had we, if not that, at least an anti-tank defense, the war would have come out the reverse. And I think that's exactly why Hitler had his military make the Panzer divisions the main instrument of the German war effort.
Well, did the Allies in World War One, did they have a lot of tanks, and the Axis, the Germans and Austrians didn't?
They were introduced over there. The tank had been developed, and of course it was certainly primitive as compared to today, but it was capable of so much when you have trench warfare and a lot of close hand-to-hand things. And so the tanks were very influential in Germany's having to retreat and lose so many people. So.
And then what was so sad was that the Germans thought they had lots of tanks, as you just said. They had all these panzer divisions. Mm-hmm. And then it turned out that the Russians were able to produce thousands and thousands and thousands of tanks.
That was
out in the east, in the eastern regions, and sent them over. Plus, they were getting them from
the good old USA.
Yeah,
that's right.
But he never imagined that they could do that, mm-hmm. but they did do it. So
we may disagree on this point, but I don't know. But I don't think Russia could have done that without USA.
The USA
material.
went to war with Japan on the mm-hmm. on the in the east there, and you know kept the Japanese busy, and he didn't have to what really turned the tide probably was around that time when the Germans were depending on the fact that they were going to be worn out. You know, mm-hmm. Just like the Germans had, lost, but not lost as much as the Russians had. But then he was able to move all these divisions from the east to the west when he found out through spies and treason that that Japan was not going to invade or bother the Soviet Union after all. They were going to turn their attention south into Singapore mm-hmm. and so on, and they were concerned about oil. As everyone was, except the Russians. And so there you had it. So that was when they put all those fresh troops, when the Germans were expecting that they would start, what do you call that when you start losing?
Fatigue and collapse.
People, there's another word, but I can't think of it. Well, unless you want to say more, it's always nice to have a leisurely ending instead of rushing off.
So, well, good show tonight. I enjoyed it, and we'll count on next week.
Okay, very good. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back next week.